But I'll be honest, a lot of churches don't have the quality. Many churches can make a joyful noise, but not a lot of churches have the quality of singers that we do here. A choir that can sing, and many, many folks that can step in and deliver the message that the Lord just did in song. Something to be thankful for. I went to a church last year to fill in, and once again, I'm not putting down. I just want you all to be thankful for what you got. And having singers. We listen to taped music of people. Not that that's bad, but in a church where you've got live people, there ought to be live singers. And I just want you to be, I want you to be thankful for what you have, because we've got a very good and strong song ministry at the church. So we'll get rolling this morning. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 5 if you want to turn over there. Title of the sermon is, Can You See the Writing on the Wall? It's a great story, and hopefully we can glean some points from it this morning. But before we get started, I think it's I always like to have a little humor. But one morning in elementary school, the students were going to a geography class. The teacher wanted to show the students where the cities and the states were. The teacher asked the class, Does anyone know where Pittsburgh is? Frances raised her hand and said, Yeah, Pennsylvania. Very good, Frances. The teacher replied, Frances, can you tell me where Detroit is? Well, sure, teacher, that's easy. That's in Michigan. The teacher again asked the rest of the class, trying to confuse the children, Well, can anybody tell me where Denver City is? Well, Ross spoke up and he said, Well, yes, ma'am, that's where the Broncos are. Yeah, that's right, Ross, that's Ross. Well, Ross, do you know where Cincinnati is? Ross said, Yeah, they're in last place. But I can report to you today, being a lifelong Bengals fan, that help is on the way. Number one draft pick. You know, I'm not like some fans here, and I don't know that he's here, but there's a certain attorney in town who changes teams every year on who his favorite team is. Well, I tell you what, if my Bengals never make it, you'll die knowing I was a true fan and not just when they happen to make it to the Super Bowl. I was reading him the other day, and he was telling me who his updated favorite team was, and he was telling me, Well, no, don't you know I've always liked them? Well, was that before or after you liked Denver or after you liked San Francisco? Because I get confused after a while. But anyway, I love him and I pick on him. You know, what would it take for God to get your attention? We did this study a few weeks back in Sunday school, so it's fresh on my mind. It's a little different this morning, the way that I'm going, but this is an offshoot of a Sunday school lesson that we recently did. So what would it take for God to get your attention? Would it be the death of a child? Would it be your house burning to the ground? Separation of a spouse? The horrible diagnosis from a doctor? Financial ruin? What would it take to get your attention? Well, we're going to read about a king today who God used a unique way to get his attention. You see, God communicates necessary things to us where we are in our life. Those people that aren't saved, God at some point will reveal a revelation to them in hoping that they will see that they're in their lost condition and make things right. Maybe throughout our Christian walk, maybe sin enters in, maybe distractions come about and God speaks to us to get our attention. Well, we're going to read about a king today who had a unique way his attention was achieved. You know, this king should have known better. He should have watched his father and his grandfather and his folks, kings that had come before him. But he had failed to do that. And there's an old saying, and we know it quite well, for those that don't pay attention to history, they're doomed to repeat it. Those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Well, our story takes place today in 539 B.C. That's right, it's an actual story. It's not just something that Daniel made up. This is historical context. We're going to talk about today the fall of the Babylonian Empire. This actually happened. And Daniel records it. And we're going to break it down and we're going to see what we can take from it. So at the beginning of Daniel chapter 5, let me kind of update you what's going on here. There's a war going on. The Medes and the Persians are trying to break through to the city of Babylon. Now, this war had been going on for about 2.5 years. And the Medes and the Persians had taken over a lot of land. They had taken a lot of the Babylonians captive. And they were doing quite well. But if you look at the inner city of the Babylon city, you could never know that they were at war. You would never know, based upon the festive environment that was happening from the king and his nobles, that they were at war. And we'll see that here in just momentarily. Now, could it be that the king felt safe behind his walls? Could it be that maybe he had people around him that told him what he wanted to hear, so he was secure in his leadership? He probably woke up every day with a smug attitude of everything's okay. Those Medes and Persians, they can't penetrate my wall. And if you can't take the capital city, then you can't win the war. Who knows what was on his mind? But we know from what we read in the beginning of chapter 5 that the king didn't have the war on his mind. He wasn't taking a look at himself, and he wasn't concerned about the Medes and the Persians. Well, let's talk about this wall for just a minute. This Babylonian wall was over 350 feet high. It was 87 feet thick. Go out here and measure from one emergency lane to another emergency lane on the other side of the interstate, and that's about the thickness, the distance of the thickness of the wall of the city of Babylon. 350 feet high, 87 feet thick, and 56 miles long. Within that city flowed the Euphrates River. Within that city, they were able to grow a garden. They were able to create food. They were able to sustain themselves. They were secure. The fact that the Medes and the Persians were taking over and making slaves of the people, it really didn't matter, because you can't penetrate my wall. So they had a party, and we're going to talk about that party. They felt like they were invincible, so let's just throw a party. They were smug. So let's begin reading Daniel chapter 5 and verse 4. Now they, being the king and his noblemen, and their wives and their concubines, and we're going to read about who all was there, just a lot of the echelon of important people in Babylon at that day, were having a party. The king wasn't worried. The king wasn't concerned. So let's have a party. And at this party, they drank wine and praised the gods, small g, of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and stone. So they were worshiping gods of these elements. Verse 5, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. So we're having a party. We're not concerned about anything. I've got my wives here. I've got my girlfriends here. Everybody's going to have a good time. We're going to drink. And not only are we going to drink, but we're going to drink from the cups and the plates of the temple that came directly from the temple that Nebuchadnezzar, his great-great-great-grandfather, had taken from the temple years ago. That's a problem. The desecration of religious symbols. And God was not happy. So God sent this hand that appeared on the wall and started writing out things on the wall. So can you see the writing on the wall? Verse 6. Then the king's countenance was changed. His thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against the other. His knees started knocking. So you've picked up two things today that you know the biblical origin of. I'm sure you've heard the phrase, can't you see the writing on the wall? When you're trying to talk to someone and you're trying to get them to see what's obvious, and you often will say the phrase, can you not see the writing on the wall? That's scriptural. Daniel chapter 5. And now you know, when your knees knock together, and I know you've heard that phrase before, in fear your knees are knocking together, that is biblical origin. You see how much of our language comes from the Bible, and yet they say we're not a Christian nation. But anyway, the king's knees were knocking together. You see, the king had a realization. He was probably a little inebriated. He was enjoying life. He felt no fear. He felt no danger. He felt no trouble with his lifestyle. So all of a sudden, a hand appeared on the wall and started writing things. Can you imagine the realization that went with that? Have you ever had a realization? Have you ever had a message you're like, wow. Maybe it's the loss of a friend. Maybe it's the diagnosis from a doctor. What's the realization that's come to you that realize to realize to you, there's obviously a higher power at stake here. A realization that I remember in my life to illustrate to you. I had some really good jobs within the state police. Really good ones that I enjoy and love to talk about. And I've told this to the Sunday school class. I don't know that I have to the oh, by the way, I dropped this. I'm sorry. It fell. I'm going to put it back. I could tell that I was going to get told on if I didn't put it back up there. Anyway, I've had some really good jobs within the state police. One of those jobs, when I first got into the cannabis suppression branch, part of what we do is we load up on helicopters and we fly around to areas of the state of rough terrain, hard to get to on foot. And where there's marijuana is grown, we drop men down a rope into the plot, we cut the marijuana, we pile it up, tie it up, and then they drop another rope, we hook to that rope, and it lifts us up out of the canopy and flies us off to a field. Now, it's a rush when you're flying around in midair and hanging there and the wind's hitting you in the face and you get to see how beautiful our state is, because we have a beautiful state. And I'll put the beauty up of it against any of the other 49. But one of the first rides that I took in this Black Hawk helicopter, and then Black Hawks are meant to transport large numbers of men and women from one place to another. And it's an extremely enormous machine. It can just take right off and take and just lift up and take off, and it's powerful, and I love to watch them in action. Well, I was sitting back there one day, and we were flying to a location in southern Kentucky, and I it was like my second time being on the helicopter. The first time you're just enamored and awe. But the second time I started looking around at all the hoses and the whistles and the buzzes and just trying to take it in. And I looked down and I saw this rope, this block of wood, probably about a 10 by 10 big block of wood, probably 6-8 inches thick. And across that block of wood was a rope. And there was tape that was taped that rope to that block. And right above that was a machete. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I wonder what that's for. And I looked and I traced that rope to the sack that they throw to rescue me. And when I say rescue, it's the rope. Remember I said they drop it down, you hook to it, they spy you out. That's what that's called. And there was this rope that I would rely on to get me out of there, especially when I'm flying in midair, has a knife that will cut it. So I asked, hey, what's that? He said, that's in case, and you don't whisper on a helicopter. You yell on a helicopter because you can't hear. He said, that's in case you get hung up down there, they'll cut you loose because we don't want to jeopardize the helicopter. This is a multi-million dollar piece of equipment. There are probably anywhere from 8 to 10 lives on that helicopter. And if you get hung up in the trees on the way up or on the way down, sorry about your luck. That was a realization to me. That was the writing on the wall. That's kind of dangerous. Maybe I'll be a detective and do it on the ground instead of coming in from the air. I'm being a little comical, but I think you get the point. You see, this king had a moment of realization. His knees started knocking. He started thinking, wow, what's going on here? And he didn't know. So he brought in his magicians. He brought in his other wise men. He brought them in. Hey, what's that mean? What's those phrases on that wall mean? What's going on here? He brought his magicians in. None of them could interpret the writing on the wall. So he reached out. The murmurings and the, what's going on? Did you hear? The king had a party, and while they were having a party, they had the writing on the wall. This hand appeared. Can you imagine the buzz around the city of Babylon while this was going on? Well, nobody could figure it out. People were coming in and looking at it. What's going on? I can't interpret it. I don't know, king. I'm sorry. Well, the king was really getting perplexed that this language, this foreign language that we don't know about, has appeared on our wall. So, the king's mother And I'll paraphrase this, and then we'll jump on to our next portion of Scripture. The king's mother said, "Hey, wait a minute. I remember, it's okay, king, we got this. I remember a man by the name of Daniel that was able to interpret a dream from your father's father, Nebuchadnezzar. And he still lives in your kingdom." Now, when Daniel was interpreting dreams for Nebuchadnezzar, he was in his teenage years. Now Daniel's about 80 years old. Well, King Belshazzar brings Daniel out of retirement, okay? And he brings him to the palace. Daniel walks in and the king tells him, "Look, if you interpret this dream, I'll give you a third of my kingdom." And Daniel says, "I don't care about that stuff. I don't care about your kingdom. My kingdom's not of this world. My kingdom's up there. But I'll tell you what that dream means. But before I tell you, you're going to hear what I got to say." Jump with me now to verse 18. Daniel chapter 5. "O thou king, the most high God," capital G-O-D, "gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor." Remember what I said? If you don't pay attention to history, you're doomed to repeat it. That's what Daniel's saying. He's recollecting. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? Did you not learn from his mistakes? He pointed out Nebuchadnezzar, the quality of initially in his kingdom. But then what happens? Verse 19. "And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, languages trembled and feared before him. When Nebuchadnezzar served God, he was blessed. Whom he would slew, and whom he kept alive, and whom he would set up, and whom he would put down." He's basically saying when Nebuchadnezzar honored God, God honored Nebuchadnezzar. But then we see a transition, verse 20. "But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him." There's that old pride thing. You all ever have to deal with that? I do. But remember what I said. You learn from history or you're doomed to repeat it. Verse 22. "And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart." Remember, Belshazzar's at war. Instead of asking God for guidance and direction to lead him out of this war, what's he do? He brings in his wives and his concubines. He has a party with his noblemen. And he drinks from the sacred cups that come from the temple of God. Completely blowing aside. I told this in Sunday school. And this is bothersome to me, but I'm going off my notes, so this is dangerous. But it's an important point to make. One of my dear friends is a jailer in Leslie County. I worked with him for many years as a trooper. When he retired, he ran for jailer, and he's now the jailer. And he tells me stories all the time. And he told me, and I verified this yet again, that you have to be careful in giving the KJV Bible, the Gideon Bible. Gideons are good about passing out Bibles. You got to be careful about giving the Bible to inmates. Because inmates smuggle in cigarettes, or they smuggle in tobacco, and they smuggle in marijuana. And the way that they smoke it is they tear out the Bible's pages, roll it up, and smoke it. You see, these pages are flammable, but they won't burn up immediately. They kind of burn to a smolder. Ideal for rolling tobacco or marijuana. But do you know, now that's how our Bible's desecrated in our prison system, but do you know that if the Holy Quran is touched by someone, a Holy Quran is touched by someone, that's a complaint leveled through the Department of Corrections, and the jailer will be dealt with severely. When you touch a holy, I can take pages out of the Bible and let the inmates smoke, but the Holy Quran, I got to wear gloves. That's where we are. That's desecration. That is what I'm trying to make with what the king had done in using the cups to drink his liquor at his drunk sex party. God was angry. God sent a hand. He wrote the writing on the wall. Belshazzar had disrespected God, and Daniel was rebuking him before he interpreted the dream. And he goes on to say, "Pride, you not humbled your heart. You have lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. I'm in verse 23. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee. And thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver, gods, small g, and gold, of brass, of iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know about thee, capital G-O-D, in whose hand thy breath is, in whose are all thy ways hast thou not glorified. You see, King Belshazzar was worshiping the small G-O-Ds, and he had ignored the capital G-O-D. You see, that's Daniel's way of telling me, through the writers of King James men, when the interpretation of the Bible, that's Daniel's way of telling me that Belshazzar's heart was not of God, not the God that we worship. Belshazzar was worshiping gods, false gods. Let's continue on, verse 25. And after Daniel got done rebuking Belshazzar, he interpreted the dream. Interpreted the writing on the wall. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing Mene. Joe, I think I've got that on slide. If you could jump that on up there. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Next slide, I think, will give the interpretation. Mene, Mene. Our days are numbered. Our days are numbered. We are not going to live forever. Last Sunday, I had a recruit class show up about 2 o'clock, and by the time I introduced myself to them, we filed ourselves into the classroom. And another instructor was speaking, and when I get messages, news messages, or a text message, or a phone call, my watch vibrates. So if I'm ever talking to you, and I look at my watch, don't think I'm bored with your conversation. Don't think that I'm like, boy, I wish I'd get done talking. Usually I've gotten a text, and I'm seeing who it is. It's instinctive. And I'm trying to do better. And I'm trying to do now when I put my hand in my pocket, and I hear the vibration of my watch to not go, to keep it in there, that way I can keep my attention on the person I'm talking to. But I have been rude, I know, when I get a text or a message and I look at my watch and people are talking to me. But it's merely that I'm getting a message. Well, I got one of those messages Sunday about 2:30, 3 o'clock on my watch. And I looked at it and it said, Kobe Bryant killed in helicopter crash. And I was like, wow. And immediately I thought, man, he's young. Great basketball player. I hate to hear that. Sorry for the family. Went about the day. I went home that night. I got on social media, and I started reading all the outcry of Kobe passing away. And a trooper friend of mine, a trooper, and he's been a trooper for several years. And listen, when you're in law enforcement, death is not a surprise to you. You see it. It's inevitable. You see it. It's in front of you. Not daily, not weekly, but you see it quite often. And this trooper who's been doing this for a while put something on social media in regards to Kobe dying that says, why? Why? How can this happen? And I want to be like, there's no promise of tomorrow. Kobe is a great basketball player and by all accounts a great dad. But are we so smug in our society that we think because he's an NBA superstar that he should get to live till he's 80 or 90 years old? Are you smug in your life that you think, well, I'm going to live till I'm 80, and at 79 and a half, I'll decide to live for Christ. King Belshazzar thought he would live forever. He was so powerful. He was so secure inside the walls of that city. Medes and the Persians. Cast them aside. Smug lifestyle. You know, maybe I remember Brother Don years ago sharing this, and this has always stuck with me. And you talk about a great anti-smug device, an anti-smug device. Maybe on our texts, maybe on our tweets, maybe on our Facebook messages, when we want to tell the world all of our intuition, maybe at the end of it we should start putting DV, DV, Deo Volente. You see, when the Puritans first arrived in the New World in the 1600s, they would write letters back home to England. The way was hard. They didn't know where their next meal was coming from. They didn't know if they would survive the next storm that was coming through. Life was fragile. There was no promise of tomorrow. They relied on a great Savior to help them through. And when they write letters back home to the old country, at the end of the letter, at the conclusion of the letter, they would write DV. Do you know what Deo Volente means in Latin? Lord's will be done. So don't think you're 41 years old and you're smug and you've got all kinds of things to offer this world. Don't think for a minute. If you're 17 or you're 25 or you're 55 or you're 75, don't think for a minute that there's a promise of tomorrow. Your days are numbered. Mene, mene. You are going to die. The second thing that was on the wall, tekel. You have been placed on God's scales and you have been found lacking. You are a sinner. You see, the king lived behind his secure wall. He thought he'd live forever. I'm going to have a party. Who cares about all those underlings that live outside the wall? I don't care about them. I only care about me. I'm smug in my life and I have all these wonderful things that I've done. But no one had told him he was a sinner. You see, Romans chapter 3 and verse 23, and this was written many years after Belshazzar lived, but it's a message for us today, very plainly says, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. You see, Belshazzar knew. He should have known because his parents, his dad, his granddad, he had watched this happen generation to generation. Serve God, prosper, serve self. Selfishness, pride enters in, and then we fall. So Belshazzar knew, or he should have known, but he didn't take note. So Tekel, he was a sinner. And the last thing, Upares, one day your kingdom will be derided among people that are left living. You can't take it with you. It doesn't matter if you're scored the most points in the NBA. It doesn't matter if you have a nice bank account. It doesn't matter if you have a nice home. It doesn't matter if you go to the gym and work out two times a day. It doesn't matter if the doctor says, hey man, awesome health, keep doing what you're doing. One day, you will die. What next? What happens? Next. You see, you can't take everything that we work for. You know, men are about occupation. If you talk to a man, one of the first words, if it's some guy you haven't seen in a while, maybe you went to school with years ago, I guarantee you within the very first comments of that conversation, hey man, what are you doing now? Men are about occupation. That's just who we are. We're proud of our accomplishments and our occupations. We're proud of our home. We're proud of what we achieve. Well, that can be a downfall. Because we lay up treasures on earth. We want to achieve a certain number in our bank account. We want to achieve a certain size house. We want to drive a certain kind of truck. Or we want to achieve and work for. And then when we talk or think, it's like, well, look what I've done. Look what I've achieved. But Upharsin reminds us that when I die, I can't take it with me. So am I building treasures that last? I love what Jack Easterby had to say. He's the vice president of football operations for the Houston Texans. This is profound. God's ways are above ours. Love others. Cherish each moment. Our impact will not be measured by points, resumes, dollars, or real estate. Our impact will depend on our relationship with a loving God and how we allowed Him to use us to change the people and the world around us. So all this blood and sweat, and I'm not saying don't support your family. I'm not saying try to strive for something. But we worry about a whole lot of things that we can't take with us. So what are you building? What kind of treasures in heaven are you building? At the end of the story, we see in Daniel chapter 5 and verse 30 and 31, after Daniel had rebuked the king, after Daniel had interpreted the writing on the wall, we see what happens next. Verse 30. And that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. The king was slain. And I find nothing in the scriptures that tell me that Belshazzar ever acknowledged God. I find nothing to where I see that Belshazzar got on his knees and got his heart right with God. So by that I am to assume that Belshazzar is in hell today. I hope he's not. I hope at some point he got saved. I hope he acknowledged God. I hope he had things right. But based upon the evidence before me in reading Daniel chapter 5, because remember, Daniel's message to me was that Belshazzar worshipped the small G-O-D and not the capital G-O-D. That's Daniel's way of telling me this was the heart of Belshazzar. And there was nothing in those verses that said Belshazzar ever... Now, he honored his commitment. He put a purple robe around Daniel and said, you get a third of the kingdom. And then before you know it, the Medes and the Persians came in. The Mede, actually, as we see here, Darius the Mede, as the Bible quotes, came in and slain the king. Just like that, his life was snuffed out. So it would appear that Belshazzar's in hell. So I did a little figuring yesterday. How long has Belshazzar been in hell? Well, this happened 539 B.C., and we're 2020, okay? So you do the simple math, and he's been in hell for 2,559 years. That's 934,035 days. 934,035 days. And here's what I want you to think about. No hope. No rescue, nothing. He's not even begun to live in hell. Because he never accepted God. He worshipped the small G-O-D. He found security in the walls. He found security in things of this world. And he lived it up and he enjoyed himself. But yet his number was called Mene. Your days are numbered. John Thomas, a religious writer from days gone by in the 1800s, coined something called the hideous doctrine. And I hope you can read it. It's lengthy, but I wanted to put it on the screen. And I want you to follow along with me. I read this and it shook me from my inner core. And maybe, if you're lost this morning, because we don't talk about hell much, and I'm not saying Brother Travis does. We talk about things in the Bible, and the Bible doesn't really talk about hell much. But today we're talking about hell. Part of the problem with us not talking about hell much, I don't know, we don't see many people saved. You say, well, what do you save from? If you don't know about hell, and we don't talk about hell, then what do you save from? And this, a lot of this message comes from a couple weeks ago. I heard a guy say that he'd have no problem partying in hell. And that bothers me because we don't talk about that hideous doctrine. John Thomas, let's see what he says. He's talking about a being, a man, a woman that's been cast into hellfire. After a roar of physical pain blasts the unbeliever, he spends his first moments wailing and gnashing his teeth. But after a season, he grows accustomed to the pain. Not because it's tolerable, but because his capacity for it is enlarged to comprehend it, and yet not be consumed by it. Though he hurts, and as he looks, he sees only blackness. In his past life, he learned that if he looked long enough, a glow of light somewhere would yield definition to his surroundings. A ray of hope not coming. So he blinks and he strains to focus his eyes, but his efforts yield only blackness. He turns and he strains his eyes in another direction. He waits, yet he sees nothing but unyielding black heat. He clings to him, smothering him. He feels for something solid to get his bearings. He reaches for walks, rocks, trees, or chairs. He stretches out his legs to feel the ground, and he touches nothing. He hangs there alone in his pain, unable to touch a solid object or see a solitary thing. He begins to weep. His sobs choke through the darkness. They become weak and then lost in hell's roar. You see, ladies and gentlemen, in hell, nobody's going to hear you scream. So this thought that you're going to party and hang out with your buddies. Everything we do here on earth has hope attached. Everything. We have hope for a better day. We have hope for a better tomorrow, where we're going to maybe get out of financial ruin, or maybe our health's going to get better. The doctor said if I do this and this and take that and that, I'll pull through and I'll be okay. We've got hope. I'm going to hope that my kids get off drugs. I'm going to hope that this can happen. I'm going to hope that that can happen. I'm going to hope I can get a bigger house. I'm going to hope I can drive a better car. I'm going to hope for a better day. Every financial woe has a hope of renewal. Every heartbreak has the hope of a brighter day. But in hell, your tomorrow is a repeat of the misery from yesterday. What about you? Belshazzar had a wall that protected him. Pretty high wall, pretty thick wall. You know, it's kind of like I used this illustration last week in Sunday school. We're kind of like a burning building. And we're standing on the ledge of that building. And we're thinking, phew, man, those firemen, they got that net for me. And that looks good, but I just don't know. I just don't want to jump. I don't want to take that leap of faith. So I'm going to hug this building. But boy, you can feel that building getting hotter and hotter. And it's eventually going to burn and take you with it. So if you jump, if you take that leap of faith, if you'll just jump out, it'll be okay. But you tell yourself, no, what will people think if I jump? I don't believe that a good God will send me to hell. I just don't think He will. And I'm going to hang on to this building, and I'm not going to jump. You willing to jump this morning? Hell's real. And just because we don't dwell on it much, just because we don't think about death much, just because we don't dwell on the awfulness of hell, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. We don't talk about it much to our kids. We don't talk about it in school at all. We don't talk about it. Shh. Don't talk about it. But even though we don't talk about it, the Bible speaks of it. We know about it in Luke chapter 16. And I don't believe that's just a parable. I don't believe that's a story that Jesus just made up. He names people. He names the people. He names Lazarus. He names the rich man. And he cites a specific incident. And I think that is a true story. I think that actually happened. So what about you? What excuse are you using as you cling to that ledge this morning? What will people think? Even at 12 years old when I first got saved, I mean, I was a good kid. I'd never really sinned. I mean, I'm a good kid. I went to Camp Kazan that summer. I was Camper of the Week. How can Camper of the Week be lost and on his way to hell? I'm a good kid. I've never done anything. I didn't look at pornography. I didn't steal. I didn't rob anybody. I was respectful. I checked on the elderly. I done good things. But an old preacher came up from Louisiana, and he talked about hell. And it scared me to death. I said, tonight's the night. I've been coming to Bible Baptist Church now for about a year, and these good people in this building think I'm saved, and I'm really nervous that what will they think? And I just sitting on the front row, and I just kind of fell forward and knelt down. And Brother Tex Amix, and I've told this story before, put his arm around me. He said, how can I help you? And I said, Brother Tex, I don't know if I'm saved. And after hearing that, I want to know I'm saved. said, let me help you. And he led me to Jesus that night. Now, there have been many days that I've disappointed God. Many days. I say it all the time. You follow me around with a clipboard, you're going to be very disappointed in your deacon, Darren Allen. But I know that I have no promise of tomorrow. I know my days are numbered. And I know that whatever I accumulate on this earth, I can't take it with me. And when I die, my kids are going to get it. My grandkids are going to get it. And that my focus needs to be on Jesus. So if you're on that ledge this morning and you're worried about what people think, or you think, well, I'm going to wait till this building just completely almost burns to the ground and then I'll jump. You know what? That's a lie of the devil, because you won't do it. And there's no guarantees how much longer that building is going to stay a wreck that you can stand there on that ledge. I hope you're picking up what I'm putting down. I hope you can see the analogy that I'm trying to make. The time is now. Let's stand together. We'll enter into a verse of invitation. And listen, if you're not saved, I would love to talk to you. We'll stroll through the Scriptures and we'll discuss how you can jump off that ledge and into eternity of heaven below and on that safety net. I would love to talk to you. But listen, your days are numbered. The fact that you're young, you think, well, I've got plenty of time, I'm in good health, I'm okay, don't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. So if God's speaking to you this morning, you come on down here and we'll talk. Brother Dan.